graduation, does that eagerness to join the consumer society actually increase the likelihood that he'll drop out of school altogether and end up on unemployment? Join KUAC TV and radio for a look at part-time work, part-time school, and tune in at the first to the TV document on Channel 9 Monday night at 7 o'clock. Then switch over to FM 105 for a community call-in discussion on Your Children, Our Children. It's just about 7 o'clock, and we'll join Patty Kostelic with the Home Fires Radio Show.
Good evening. I'm Patty Kostelic, and this evening we've got a subject that I can really warm to. We're going to talk about computers and the effect that they are having and they are going to have on all of our lives. With me in the studio this evening are Con Dietz, who is the new executive director of the University of Alaska Computer Network. He has come to us from North Dakota, where he was the director of the Computer Center there for 17 years, and Tom Hassler, who is an associate professor of information science. He's a friend of mine. He's also a reader on the Northern Storyteller. Yes, yes, yes. And a computer person...
For the last 16 years.
For the last 16 years. I guess I'll just let you do some talking, and then I'll jump in with... questions. What difference is this going to make for us?
Not
or is that too all-encompassing
a
question?
Oh, not at all, Patty.
Okay.
Not at all.
Go.
No, I don't know. We'll see what's happening. This is an awkward position. You see, Conrad's my boss for another 2 months, so I got to be careful what postures I take. But
I don't think you have a boss, Tom.
No one wants to take the job on.
Take the blame. But I'd like to start off by suggesting that the computers, I'll ask a question whether you, Patty, know who the largest manufacturer of computers in the world today is. That'll be the first question I'll ask you.
Oh, this is Turnabout is Fair
Play. Turnabout is Fair Play.
The largest manufacturer.
Who produces more central processing units or microprocessors than anybody else in the world today? It's General Motors.
I would never have said. I was sort of vacillating between IBM because of the hoopla of taking over the market and so on, and something.
Right. General Motors produces more microprocessors than anybody else. They're using them in their automobiles. They're using them in their microwave ovens and their Frigidaire refrigerators. You know, they've got little microprocessors, and they're producing more microprocessors than anybody else. So if you want to know, are computers going to influence the world we live in? Virtually none of us have been untouched by it. If you have a gasoline credit card, when you get your bills back, you look on the backside of it, and there's little funny red marks on them. Those are an optical reading technique. Technology is used to be able to encode the information that's already contained on that cards that from your charge slip. We run into them down at the JCPenney store. Anybody else in town who's using the optical character recognition wands? So we're measured and sized up by computer automated technology everywhere we turn. As to how important they are or how they're going to influence us or how much we need to know about them, there I'll take a different posture than a lot of other people, because my take on it is that computer literacy is probably the biggest overblown hot air bag of wind that we've seen in many, many years.
Thank God for that.
I didn't know, Tom, that General Motors was the largest producer of microprocessors. There is a difference between microprocessors and microcomputers and computers themselves. And even though they have the name computer or micro in them, they do operate quite a bit differently.
Good. For the computer illiterate in my audience, out living in log cabins with only battery-operated radios, could you define the difference here? Explain a little bit about what the difference is, so we have some common definitions.
Right. Inside any computer, you've got to have an electronic component that's going to take instructions and data and act out the instructions and perform those instructions upon a given set of information or data that you've got. That electronic component is called a processor or an information or data processor, or what we call a CPU if you want to get into the heavy acronymology. By the way, that's a suggestion I would make to our chancellor here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, that there's a vacuum in academia. Nobody has yet put together a college of acronymology. There's alphabet soup all over the world.
That would be
and
excellent.
Nobody has yet decided that they ought to move into that. A friend of mine down at Arizona State University sent out a memo as a gag on April 1st a couple of years ago saying that no acronyms were to be allowed at Arizona State University without his permission. Lo and behold, within a month, he had like 300 requests for approval for new acronyms.
Full-time job. Introductory.
Introduction
anyway, to acronyms.
Right. But we, all seriousness aside, we've got things called CPUs, which are central processing units, and that's the formal jargon term that we would use, or the acronym we would use, to talk about the electronic component that does the actual instructions on a set of data that you've got. A microprocessor is simply a very small, shall we say, for the layperson, very small processor. It's very, very physically small. A microcomputer, however, is when you have all of the other pieces and bits and cables put together to have a whole computer system. That is, you have some other input and output devices like keyboards and screens or a printer, maybe some kind of electronic device that you can store data on for keeping your files for use over a period of time.
Where do chips come in?
Well, chips come in usually with bacon and onion dip. No, your chips are simply the medium, the new electronic medium called semiconductors that the Fairchild Corporation started back in the late 60s that allow us to have the equivalent of what we call transistors, which are an electronic component, of a not great number of them available to us on a very, very small area. We can have maybe a centimeter square, quote, chip that has today as many as up to 450,000 transistors on them.
Wasn't there a recent breakthrough?
Yes, Nippon Electric has announced that they now can produce chips that are a centimeter on a side that can store 1 million bits of information, a bit being either a numerical zero or one signal. There's codes, and we don't want to go into computer literacy here because it's really not
needed. No, we want to talk about trends, but... Is it true that the space program has really helped develop this technology?
Yeah, along with probably the space. Although, ironically, one of the things I enjoyed was the fact that on one of the early NASA missions, they were using handheld calculators to do a lot of numeric functions because NASA has such a long cycle for procurement of any sort of equipment, particularly technical equipment.
Ordering the equipment and
exactly,
waiting
and the lead
years
times and all the
in.
Testing. Right. That they, therefore, said, well, look, we can go buy these little calculators for $400, you know. Let's go buy an HP calculator and use that instead. And indeed, they knew, I don't know how many people paid real close attention, but when Neil Armstrong landed the first Apollo capsule on the moon, they knew ahead of time that the computer would not be able to calculate fast enough to land him properly. And therefore, he would have to take over manual control of the ship to land it. And that's what actually happened. The reason it was a Raytheon computer in the capsule, and they knew that indeed that it would have taken them an extra 2 or 3 years, and they would have been that much later in getting to the moon if they had gotten a computer that was fast enough at that time to do all the calculations. The guy really was impressive because I know if I were in that situation, my pulse beat would have gone up to about 900 and a zillion, right? And Armstrong, they were monitoring his bodily signs, his pulse and things, and his pulse actually, when he took over command to physically land the capsule, slowed down. He was that kind of a cool character. Mm. So there are places, for your listeners to be aware, there are places that, by gosh and by golly, where human beings are still a heck of a lot better and more adaptable and easier to program than computers are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a... There are a lot of transitions that we're going through in the 20th century. Obviously, we've weathered fairly well several in the last few decades, and this is another one facing us. But it's difficult to sort of get everything to even out. I remember a real annoyance with billing systems when they first went over to computers because you'd call up and you'd say, I've got somebody's long-distance phone bill from Texas. What is wrong here? It's the computer's fault. Well, my feeling at the time and still is, someone has to put the information into the computer. And the computer is just sort of this neutral force, and every mess-up that occurs, to blame it on the computer is a real frustrating thing for the customer and causes, I think, a lot of rejection of this technology that when things go wrong, it's out of our hands. It's almost Allah's will. You know, it's the computer did it. No one's responsible, and we have no idea how it'll ever get straight because it's real difficult to talk to a computer, or at least it has been in the past. Maybe that'll change. But
that may change, but I think it's interesting to note that there's a saying, something like this, that to err is human, but to really follow things up, it takes a computer. And very few people see my error, but lots of people see the computer error, or the error that is not necessarily made by the computer. As you said, it's usually the input into the computer that makes the error. There's another saying, garbage in, garbage out. But so many people see the errors that are created by computer, whereas very few people see my errors, and that's why they became so visible.
Well, that plus there's a multiplier effect with computers, I think, is very real. If I have a pen in my hand and I'm going to write a check, and if I have the wrong balance or the starting balance, whatever, I write one check, and if I put the wrong digits down or I write the wrong amount into the amount line, that's one check that's an error. But in the Navajo Reservation Data Processing Center where I worked before I came to Alaska, we printed 7,600 payroll checks every 2 weeks. And the computer was given certain values to use to calculate those paychecks. If you goof up one of those values, you're not goofing up one check. You've got this multiplier effect where you're going to goof up potentially 7,600 payroll checks. And if you have a wrong deduction or a wrong withholding kind of an amount, you've got that multiplier effect. And it's because they've got this, they can deal with so much data so quickly and so uniformly, and they're going to make the same mistake consistently for you. That's what's so nice. They're such faithful servants for you there.
The logic on the computer system up here just infuriates me. You know, one space wrong, one comma wrong, one lowercase or uppercase mistake, and it just tells you it doesn't know what you're talking about. And I'm sitting there saying, you do too, no.
I think that's the thing that's going to change in the future. I think we're talking about user-friendly. And certainly a user-friendly system will forgive you for making some small mistakes.
Really?
But yeah, I think so. Mine does. Or it tells me, it beeps, and I can go back and correct myself. It doesn't knows essentially what I want to do.
But it is infuriating when you get an error message out of a computer, omitted comma in position 17, and you say, well, by gosh, if you knew there was a comma missing in column 17, why didn't you just put it in for me?
I'd like to come back a little bit to unless we give a wrong opinion to what Tom was talking about earlier about the space program, excuse me. I don't think the space program would have ever gotten off the ground if it weren't for computers. Let's not give the impression that we could have done it without computers, even handheld calculators.
Yeah, my grandfather told me that the most miraculous thing in his whole lifetime was sending someone to the moon. And I asked him why. I said, you know, you've seen a lot of technology pop up. What is it about the space program that's so special? And he said, well, I recall when I was a child that they said that it was physically impossible to calculate with a paper and a pencil using sophisticated mathematical formulae the relative positions of three bodies moving in space. And if you think about it, if you're going to send someone to the moon, you've got to calculate the position, the movement of the Earth is moving, the moon is moving, and the space capsule is moving. And he said that was an impossibility in his youth. And so to him, it was impressive as a Dickens that they were able to have computers that were able to figure out how to handle those calculations fast enough, rapidly enough, that they could send someone to the moon. However, the other thing that's scary that I did not realize until several months ago, I read an article about the space project, that we think, I mean, we really were quite pleased that we actually got these chaps to the moon and we got them back in one piece. And I thought, isn't that marvelous? They have such perfect pieces of computer programming to do this with. Well, apparently this was not the case. And one of the words and one of the concepts that has come up in the world because of computers and programming is the idea of what we call a bug. A bug is loosely defined as a mistake or an error in logics in the in the flow of a computer program. You have a list of instructions you're giving, and you give a wrong instruction, and you may not catch it for some time, and that's called a bug. The history of the bug, by the way, there is a photograph of the original bug, which was physically an insect that landed in the ENIAC computer down at the University of Pennsylvania Moore School for Engineering. And they had it caused a short inside the computer system, and they found an actual physical bug. So, the computer's not working. There's a bug in it. And that's where the term bug comes from.
And there was a true bug.
There was a true bug. But it turns out that a gentleman who was talking with some programmers who were working on the NASA programs to send gentlemen to the moon on the space capsules said, gee, how did you ever get all those programs debugged? They're huge. And the guys who worked on it said, we didn't. It turned out that 5 days before they fired off that first mission to the moon, someone found out that they had made a mistake and that they had the moon's gravitation factored in mathematically as a repulsion rather than an attraction, which would have meant that had they used those programs, these poor guys would have gone off into Never Never Land. And they just happened to catch it. They said, well, how did you get them back? They said, we were quite lucky.
Well, I think, in fact, there was a fire or a mission did fail because of a computer error, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. I just happened to grab this book today, and I've had very little time with it. And hopefully members of our audience have read this book and have some more detailed reaction to it. The book is called Megatrends by John Nesbitt, and he says he's talking about the information era and the fact that this is the information age, and we've been talking about that really since the 50s. There's been such an acceleration of information. He says, quote, it's important to think about the computer as a tool that manages complexity, because just as surely as highways only encourage more cars, having a tool that manages complexity invites more and more complexity into the society. And, Con, I know just before the program you said you'd read this book, and could you talk a little bit about the things he says and your reaction to them? Or is that...
Well, the thought that runs through my mind as you read that, Patty, is that the computer is really the only thing that allows us to deal with humanity and with the amount of information that's available today and the amount of information that we're required to use to survive in today's society and to be successful. I don't know how we're going to define successful. It's difficult to do without the computer. I think the computer can help us do that. And I think that's one of the points that Nesbitt makes. I don't know if that responds to...
I guess from my point of view, and both of you can react to this, it's a little overwhelming at the Women's Center. Now, as my small department is more and more well-known, across my desk comes everything that people from other departments in the university get that has the word woman in the title. And so it's a tremendous amount of articles and things come in, and they sort of pile up on my desk, and I have access through software to bibliographies that tell me everything that's being written about women from every angle and so on. And it seems that just sort of putting the information in files and trying to absorb it becomes a full-time job, and I don't even have time to read it. I mean, now at my fingertips is every book written about or for women in the last 20 years, but when do I can spend all my time sort of finding out where it is and what the titles are, but it's real hard to then just to get down to the level where you can absorb it and do something.
Well, that's what you'd really like to do. You'd like to be able to have the computer search for you until it found exactly what you needed to know, and then give you the few articles that pertain to that particular topic.
And that depends on good titling and good categorizing.
Or good computers. Computers can search through and find keywords out of text, if you will. So it's a matter of whether or not we will use keywords. I don't know that we will eventually. I think we'll just have the computer search and find those keywords that we're interested in.
Audience, our number is 474-5044. If you have any questions for my guests or you'd like to add something to this conversation, please call 474-5044. There's so much to talk about here. We're sort of going hither and yon. The software proliferation is incredible. It just in the last 2 years, the kind of programs that you can get.
There are over 5,000 computer programs now available, commercial computer programs now available for the IBM personal computer. And I understand there are more than that available for the Apple computers.
Tell us what some of them do, just as an example.
Well, you're going to give me a chance to get off on my favorite subject if you ask that question, Patty, because...
Oh, well, good.
I really think that computers should be used to improve our productivity. And, in fact, that's what they did in the space program. That's what they did in business. That's what they do in banks. They make each individual that works in that bank more productive and each organization more productive. And I'd like to see us do that more in higher education period. I think I share Tom's view that computer literacy is not very important. What is important is using computers to enhance education. I think we've spent a lot of time in education, and we're still doing it, especially in the grade schools. You know, every grade school has to have a computer, and why? I don't see any reason for that unless we're going to use the computer to make education easier or better or to improve the quality of education or something like that, or make the teacher more productive.
So it isn't just learning the computer. You have to learn something.
That's right. I'd like to see us use the computer to help the teacher teach more kids or more subjects in the same amount of time with less work or the same amount of work.
Those kind of programs would be the ones where there are programs for children where everyone can go at their own pace, and you get immediate response every time you make a mistake.
Well, did you ever see how fascinated the children are with these computerized games? They just are fascinated. Why can't we make education that fascinating? Tom and I were talking about that. As a matter of fact, when I interviewed here, I remember now he was showing me an Apple program that was a very fascinating program.
Yeah, although we have to be cautious because unless we're going to go totally, we're on the educational issue here, and unless we're willing to go totally into computers and do it well, we have the same kind of phenomenon that we've had with some of our educational television. It takes 50 person hours of effort minimum to produce 1 hour of Sesame Street on public broadcasting. And some of the shows will take up to 100 person hours of effort to pull a show together. And yet, here are these teachers in the primary schools in our district and other districts around the country who are putting in maybe have time to put in a couple of hours for a whole day's worth of work. And how can any teacher, God love them, how can any teacher compete with Big Bird and the Cookie Monster and all of this other marvelous animation and other visual things that we can pull together in a Sesame Street? They just can't compete. And I think that we want to be careful that we don't somehow give the impression subliminally or consciously to students that you can learn things without any effort. You know, eventually at some point, we can make it more palatable. And what I find, what I was showing Conrad, Patty, was a program, computer program called the Pinball Construction Set.
And we've talked about this. This is amazing.
Yes, and in my
software.
Mind, it's a marvelous tool. Although it's a game, in one sense, to me, it's a marvelous way to teach programming and interesting ways to think and to conceptualize for any child. And it's a micro environment. It's a whole way.
Could
it's a
you
whole
tell us
world.
What it is?
Well, on a microcomputer, you can take this software, and my gosh, I scratch my head and I think about it. It cost me $40 down at the local computer store in town, and I think about how easily in Fairbanks, at least, you drop $40. You know, in Fairbanks, you break a 20, and it's small change at that point. But I bought this software and took it home, and I loaded it up, and you take your what's called a joystick that allows you to move a little kind of a finger around the screen, and you can move it around and move what we call icons, which are little pictorial representations on your screen. You can move them around on your screen and shuffle them around and create on the screen a representation of a pinball game. And then you can play it. I mean, you get five balls and you have flippers you can control. And
so you
can control.
Make your own pinball machine.
You make your own pinball game. And what's marvelous is that once you start playing with this software, the gentleman, Bill Budge, who wrote the program, was a very, very far-seeing and broad-minded and incisive kind of a mind. I just love to meet the guy sometime. Because what he did is that if you play the game and you say, well, you know, wouldn't it be fun to see what would happen if gravity were a bit stronger? Well, you can go in and change gravity. Or you can say, you know, what would happen if I had bumpers that were a little more bumpy? Well, you can go in and change the bumperness of your bumpers on your pinball set. So it's not that you're just playing a game. You're building the game, and to my mind, you are programming. You're not programming in the typical language statements of Fortran or BASIC or Logo or Algol or COBOL or any other computer language. You're programming with visual symbols. And when you pull all of these together, your result, rather than being a payroll program or a spreadsheet program, is a game.
And
cause and effect. And I've watched my own children, you know, Julie and Emily, when they get going on this thing, you know, they start building games. It's a real gas for them to sit there and say, well, you know, I wonder if I moved it just a little bit to the left, maybe it would go a little differently. They're learning geometry because the ball is bouncing around, and if it gets stuck or it bounces funny at one point on the board and it goes down the slot they don't want it to, they've got to go change it. And I think that's, to me, an appropriate use of computers in education. I don't know whether the teachers listening are going to agree with me on that. But to me, that's an interesting way to use computers in education, in that you are doing something that could not be done any other way. Conrad and I are both old enough that we've run into what are called programmed instruction textbooks that they had. They were a fad back in the 60s, and they were garbage. They were lousy then, they're lousy now. And there are, gosh knows, far too many computer programs out there today that you can buy, all in the name of education and in the hallowed halls of academia, that are nothing but a computer version of these crummy programmed instruction texts that we had back then. They were lousy then, they're lousy now. They're not doing anything different. But when you have a thing like the pinball construction set, there is no way that I can replicate that with paper and pencil. And in a classroom or at home, that kind of environment, mental environment, intellectual environment for a child or an adult. I have another program I got called Rocky's Boots, which teaches Boolean logic, and I was embarrassed. It's got a funky little picture of a raccoon on the cover of the software when I bought it. And I thought, oh, you know, I read the label. It said, for children, 7 and up. And I thought, I can handle this stuff. I found out, Patty, I'm part of the up. You know, there are parts of that game that I just can't beat. And it's marvelous, you know, again, but it allows you to visually and intellectually play with ideas and concepts. And that, to me, is where computers and education really ought to be going, and where I see the most excitement.
Our number is 474-5044. Go.
Yeah, I want to emphasize something that I think Tom has been saying, and that is we really shouldn't think of computers as teachers at all. I'd like to see them used to enhance education. And in this case, what they did was they motivated the student to learn how to program. So why can't we motivate him to find out more information about geography, find out more information about how animals live, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
I think computers can be a great motivational force in education.
But you still have to do the learning, and you still need the human touch. Nesbitt, and again, I've just glanced at this book, talks about high-tech, high-touch. And he talks about the commensurate need for human involvement. He in the little that I've read, seems mm-hmm. to doubt that this cottage computer idea of everyone having their terminal in their house and staying home and not having to get fouled up on bumper-to-bumper traffic on the highways is probably not very realistic, that people will rebel against the idea of not associating personally with their associates, that they are going to want that face-to-face, even if it's not as efficient.
Oh, they definitely will. Some of the biggest meetings in the world are held with computer people.
Now, that's an excellent point. That's right. All of you could never see each other face-to-face. You should all be able to just get on your terminals, hook them into the phone, and...
But there is something about the more technological we get, the more we want to visit and to touch bases with other people. I think people think of computer freaks, as we're called sometimes, as sitting behind our desk and never coming out. And that isn't true. We really value personal contact and communication otherwise.
He makes a point that he thinks that the increased popularity of soft colors, pastels in particular, coziness, plumpness, the unstructured look in clothes, links to the past. He uses folk art, he says, is the perfect counterpart to the computerized society. No wonder handmade quilts are so popular. I'm quoting him. Even country music's popularity is partly a response to the electronic rock or the electronic age. So he thinks that some of this resurgence of folk arts and handcrafts and so on is some kind of the high-touch response to high-tech.
Well, Christopher Evans, in his book The Micro Millennium, makes a prediction that, in fact, microprocessors may well bring back and usher in, it may take us some number of years, but it may usher in the ultimate in craftsmanship, and that there's a reason that the Industrial Revolution went to mass production, and we all criticize it one way or another, one time or another, in one way or another. We say, you know, gee, look at all the inhumanizing effects of mass production. And yet mass production allowed people, as an example in England, you know, all of a sudden they could have a bed, an iron bed to live in, or a brass bed, whatever. It was mass-produced, but by gosh, they had something to live on. And there's simply the sheer numbers of items of consumable goods that were required by the public to raise a standard of living of any culture and society was beyond what could be comfortably made by hand craftsmen. But what Christopher Evans talks about is he suggests that, hey, what will happen in, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, probably more like 40, 50 years out, when we get to having what we call artificially intelligent machines that are able to handle all kinds of other production requirements beyond our current notion of what robots do in factories? And what if we get to a point where all of the means of production and sustenance for us are taken care of by robots and other intelligent machines? At that point, there will no longer be the necessity for you or me or anybody else to be on an assembly line worrying about saying, my gosh, I'm getting paid by piecework. I've got to get out 49 bedsteads this afternoon or I'm going to not get paid enough to pay my mortgage payment. Instead, you can say, well, gee, you know, it doesn't matter whether I work or not. So you know what I'm going to make? I'm going to make a cabinet. I've never made a cabinet, and I'm going to take a year to do that. And that indeed that the motivation and the time and the environment where a person's material needs are going to be met may then allow them to work on crafts and work on skill and quality workmanship in a way that we've never before been able to enjoy.
Or that recently we can't afford to do simply because we don't have
right.
the time and human hours are becoming very expensive.
But what I'd like to make sure we discuss and don't miss in our talk about computers tonight is the fact that those people who, whether they become craftsmen or not, may not need to know anything about computers. I don't know how many people in your listening audience know an electron from a proton from a neutron. But by gosh, I'll bet there's not a one of them that if they go into a house that has electricity, don't know how to turn on a light switch and have a light go on. Now, my point, my analogy there is you can use technology for your own immediate needs and benefits without having to understand it. You don't have to understand electricity to be able to use a radio or a light or electric stove. You simply have to know, be instructed how to use it. One of the great myths is that we're in an information age and somehow this is somehow miraculous and marvelous and wonderful. What people are not telling you is the fact that the people who are involved in information industries today are getting paid less than half what their counterparts in the production industries are being paid. They are also not telling you that although they claim by 1990 that about 30 million jobs in the United States will be related to computer technology, they're not telling you that of those 30 million jobs, that includes the people who are using the technology without needing any understanding of it. For instance, you've got a checker at Safeway store or Market Basket who's using some sort of a barcode reader, and those people do not need to know how the computer works, and yet they're considered part of the information age because they're using computer technology.
Mm-hmm. You don't know how you don't need to know how it works in order to know that when your car's
right.
screaming at you, put on your seatbelt
right.
your seatbelt on.
I agree. That's a good point.
We have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Okay. I have a question about a machine that perhaps you're familiar with called a TTY, which is used by deaf people to communicate through a telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is that one person on one end who has this machine types something in, and then it's transmitted through the telephone, and it comes out on the other end so the person can read it. And that's fine, but it still only allows a deaf person to communicate with somebody who has this TTY also.
I see.
And what would be more useful, of course, is that person could type it in, and then that the typing was turned into a voice that anybody with any telephone could understand, and then the person on just the normal telephone could speak, and that was transmitted back to the deaf person as writing.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me that that first part, transmitting from writing to speaking, is very easy because you hear that all the time with computers, and it's probably the second part which is very difficult to transmit from speaking back to writing, I assume, because people speak so differently. And what my question is how close is that to being developed? Is it developed and still too expensive to be marketed, or is the technology not there to do that, to transmit when you speak in to put that, for a computer to put that down into writing?
Good question.
I'm really glad you called, because we're evaluating that right now. As you may or may not know, the University of Alaska is a very big user of electronic mail. And we know that it is possible to convert that electronic mail to voice output. And there are computers that process the printed or the stored electronic mail and convert it to voice. We would like to know how big a demand there is for something like that. We feel there are a lot of handicapped people, blind people who can't read, deaf people who can't hear, going either way.
Mm-hmm.
If you're blind, you want to hear it. And if you can't read it, then you want to type it out and you want to be able to say it to somebody else and you want to have them convert back to you. That's the bigger problem, however, to take the voice and convert it to digital output or printed output. That's a more difficult task than it is to take the printed word and convert it to voice. I think we have the technical capability to do it now. We don't necessarily have the funding, but I think the funding could be found to do that if there was a demand.
The biggest problem is that you've got, as the caller indicated, is that there are vagaries in each person's voice, and the vocabularies of computers which are able to do speech, what we call speech recognition, and convert an audible speech input into printed or otherwise other machine characters, the vocabularies of most of those systems, unless you get a rather expensive computer, are limited at this point. But I think Conrad's right on track with saying, yes, indeed, the technology is available. It's a matter of how affordable it is right now. And I would mention, Patty, that probably most Alaskans have listened without knowing it to a computer-generated voice. Very large numbers of the telephone system's recorded messages are not a strict message that was recorded by a human being on a tape like you have at your home cassette tape player, but rather they digitally record the different sounds, the what we call phonemes, that go into making up words, and they store all of these phonemes in a computer. Then when you have a given telephone error condition, you've gotten a wrong number or exchange or whatever that doesn't exist, they take an error message that is simply a set of codes that allow a computer to go in and fetch these phonemes that are stored in the computer, fetch them out, and send them down the telephone line to you, and you'll listen to them. And something like 80% to 90% of the telephone messages, was my understanding, that are that we hear today, at least in the lower 48, from a long-distance telephone error message, are that sort of a message. So we're listening, as it were, to a computer talking to us.
Well, I came to Alaska in February. Since I've been here, I was called by a computer.
Yes, from outside, asking you to buy something or offering you some. We've been called a couple of times by a computer, mm-hmm, from somewhere.
I don't remember what it was about, but I just remember being called by a computer.
Is it? You mentioned vocabulary, but presumably you could be given a list of vocabulary that the computer knows. What about accents, a difference in accents? Is that a problem?
It can be. There's a number of sophisticated techniques that are being developed. And it's interesting, let's take that as a jump-off point, to consider the fact that one of the things that computers are doing for us is it's giving us a new way of looking at the functioning of human beings. In other words, when we go to try to synthesize speech out of a computer, or in conversely, when we go to try to recognize speech by a computer, we have to start to look very closely at how human beings make speech or how human beings understand speech. And that whole discipline and that exercise of going through trying to figure out how humans do it to be able to make a computer do it has given us tremendous insights into the human being. And that's a human side of computing that's often missed.
A parallel to that is the incredible difference in sports analysis that's been done with computerized analysis of body movement, the way they can slow it down, and at least I understand from the interviews they've done with some athletes, it's made tremendous difference in their performance, being able to watch that computer analysis of the muscles and so on, and they're really able to take that into themselves and improve their performance as a consequence.
Remember the bionic man and the bionic woman.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's remember them. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I have yet to purchase a small computer for myself because I'm not interested in sitting around and playing games or modeling the universe or anything such as that or word processing. What I am interested in is receiving real-time data and processing and charting things like stock quotes, scientific data, commodity markets, following international news and things like that. And I was wondering if there's any large bulk databases or real-time sources available to Fairbanks area residents.
Good question. Con.
I can't say that I have done that since I've been here either, but I know there are databases like that available, and I believe that they are available to you through through Timeshare, which is marketed locally here by Alascom.
What sort of a price range are you talking about for that service?
Well, I know that I think it's that some of the service, I'm not sure everything you would want to use would be available on CompuServe or The Source. Typically, those services would charge you between $5 and $15 an hour, depending upon the service you use and the time of the day that you call. If you call at night, obviously you get by with less time.
Is that a long-distance call?
Oh, Carla just tells me that in Alaska it's $25 an hour and it doesn't matter what time.
I see. Okay, Alaska is different. I'm sorry. I'm still
from the
outside.
Source.
I'm still outside.
Yeah, she says from the source it's $25 an hour no matter what time of
day. That's a local call.
It is a local call. That's right. Timeshare. You call a timeshare number that you could pick up from Alascom.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think Dow Jones has a separate service, do they not? I know there's also, I'm not familiar with them myself, but I know in a number of magazines I read that they've talked about a lot of commodities and futures databases that are available that farmers in the Midwest use. Now, how we would access them from Fairbanks, I'm not sure.
I really would compliment this gentleman because he's using computers to make himself more productive. He can't analyze all of that data by hand. So he's going to use them properly, and I congratulate him for that.
I certainly don't want to run out of time without bringing up the point that this can be very frustrating. I think a lot of the ads indicate that it's just a snap, that anybody can just buy their computer, and if you've got the money, bring the computer home, you plug it in, and away you go. And I know a lot of people who feel that that just is not clearly the case.
Oh, Patty,
you want to react to this?
Absolutely, Patty. That's something that Con and I have talked about a number of times. And it's frustrating as computer professionals to us that in the literature that we read, that 60 to 70% of all the computer systems installed, disappoint the users. And there are a number of reasons why this happens, probably the most predominant being that the expectation of the user is not calibrated or not set at an appropriate level. If people had the same kind of 60 to 70% disappointment rate with automobiles, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler would have been out of business years ago. I don't know why computers persist.
Because we're intimidated. We think if we don't get with these programs, we're going to be left behind.
Right. And that's something before the end of the show I think we ought to go back to as well. But indeed, that is a problem. And it's frustrating because the vendors do put forward advertisements that say you don't have to. I mean, during the Super Bowl, whatever, you watch the ads. I won't name any names because I've gotten enough trouble on that already in my life. But they had ads that said, "Oh, Charlie, you don't have to know nothing about computers. You don't? No, you just go down and get one of these little things, and our fish company's going to be on Easy Street." You know, and the impression is, "Oh, look, Daddy's so smart. He's working with a computer now." It's all Madison Avenue hype. What they're not telling you is that if you look at the 20 occupations, as an example, that are going to generate the most new jobs in the next 10 to 20 years, not one of them is in a high technology area. It turns out that the Department of Labor sees that the jobs that are going to be opening up, there'll be about maybe 150,000 jobs for computer programmers, as an example, during the next 10 years, whereas there are going to be 800,000 jobs for new fast food workers who don't have to know anything about computers. So all of these ads are telling us, and all of the companies are telling us, and all of their hype, computer literacy, go out and buy a computer. I know a couple of years ago my sister called me and she said, "Tom, why would I want to buy a computer? People say you keep your recipes on it. What earthly good would it do to keep my recipes on a computer?" And I said, "It wouldn't do you any earthly good." I said, "There's a marvelous little way to keep your recipes on these little pieces of cardboard. They're 3 inches by 5 inches. They're portable. They're easy to change. You just take a little rubber thing on the end of a pencil. You can erase them. You know, they're really nice little media to use. You can put them in front of the box that you're, you know, using to pour the rice out of or whatever. They're marvelous." She now has a computer. I went and saw her a couple of weeks ago back in Pennsylvania, and she said, "You know, I'm really having a fun time with this." But she said, "I'm doing," and she's a teacher, you see. So she's, and for her kids, and she's exploring the microenvironment. She's got the some of the programs I mentioned earlier. She's doing those kinds of things, and she's enjoying that as a recreational thing. But as far as her ever getting into recipes, or I have a friend in Juneau who, he said, "Oh, I got a program to take care of my checkbook." And I said, "Oh, really?" Well, it took him 6 months to get all of his data entered. And he had to order checks. And he scrubbed his brow and he said, "My God, why did I ever do that?" He said, "It takes me 3 times longer to pay my bills than it ever did before." He's been frustrated. Other people I've talked to have had the same experiences.
On the other hand, I would like, before you go on, to tell us about your colleague who bought a computer to convert her patterns, her knitting patterns.
Well, that's a good point. I do have a colleague who read about in a knitting journal that she gets that indeed there was software that would do all kinds of marvelous conversions for her. Now, I don't understand knitting. You have to remember, worth a darn. But she said that apparently the size of the needles and the size of the yarn and the stitching that you've got for going through knitting is all set for given sizes. I mean, you got, you know, size 8 needles or whatever they are and size 10 yarn. And that if you change the yarn or you change the needles, then you've got to translate all of the knitting pattern over. Well, she read that, indeed, some woman had been so frustrated by the headache she'd had trying to convert that she wrote a computer program to do that. And this woman decided as how she'd had enough. She, for whatever reasons, always wants to change the needles or always wants to change the yarn. I don't know, maybe she's got a strange size shoulders or head or something for her hats and sweaters. But whatever, she decided that, by gosh, it was worth it to her. This is Alaska, so you can do these kinds of things. It was worth it to her to go buy a microcomputer and buy these programs to be able to do that conversion for.
So that's a pattern useful for a child's sweater in mohair can be converted to a bulky wool
exactly
for an adult size
right
with a touch of a finger. Now, that's productivity. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I have a personal experience I'd like to relate before we get too far away from the subject of easy to use or user friendly. Excuse me. I think that's partly the fault of computer professionals. We have said, "Oh, that's easy to do on the computer." I've said it myself quite a few times. And I've been in computers now since 1961, and I don't think in the first. In about the first 2 or 3 years, I learned a tremendous amount about computers. And then I continued to repeat that 2 years of experience time and time again. So altogether, I probably have 2 years' experience. But about a year ago, I had a new experience because I got my first microcomputer. And I thought before that, what do I need a microcomputer for? I have the big processor. I can use that at my job and everything. But there was one fascinating thing that I liked, and that is the ability to do better planning using data or the spreadsheet analysis. And I thought I would chip in and use my spreadsheet just like that, just like I learned Fortran and just like I learned BASIC after I knew Fortran and so on and so forth. It wasn't so. I just kept track unofficially and rather informally, but I spent over 20 hours just learning how to get by using my spreadsheet.
We'd certainly have to call you computer literate before you even started this.
I would think so.
Yeah.
So that gives you an idea of how much time you have to invest if you're going to use computers seriously.
Mm-hmm. It's like learning to type. I mean, when you sit down at the computer, it's a process that has
right.
to be learned. Each program has to be learned. And
in Fairbanks, I think we're quite fortunate, and I think that we have a tremendous opportunity, and it was really driven home to me during a two-week trip outside earlier this last month in April, and going to eight or ten different burgs and finding in the lower 48 and finding out just how weak they are in their support groups for computing. In Fairbanks, we have pretty much any kind of level of support and training that a person could want to get in computing today, and we're really, Fairbanks can be quite proud of it. At the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District level, we have Kathy Chimlowski, who is in charge of the community extension. Well, I'm not quite sure what the title is, but they have a computer lab down at Ryan Junior High School in which they have community service courses as well as running programs for the school district. And I think that Helen Barrett is also involved with that. My apologies if I get the wrong person.
If someone
knows
another way, they can call us.
Right, they can call us on that. If you're interested in, so there are some courses offered through the boroughs, what do they call it, the community school program, whatever it is, and I think Helen Barrett's the one in charge of that. But I know they're doing some very nifty things, and I can vouch for the quality of the programs that those people put out. If you are a little more serious and say, gee, I'd really like to learn a programming language, Tennessee Valley Community College offers a tremendous selection of courses, and Joe Dart's the head of that program, and again, he's one sharp fellow. He can hit everything from robotics. He's got a hero robot that some of his students have been programming on through all kinds of levels of sophistication in Logo and Pascal and BASIC. And if you're interested in getting into the business administration area or business programming, Howard Zach runs a program at UAF in the School of Management that's quite useful. And if you're interested in computers, and by gosh and by golly, you're just absolutely adamant that you're going to learn everything you can about computers in the purest sense, there's a computer science department at UAF.
But you better register early.
That's right.
Those courses just fill up instantly. If you're a Express student, you can really forget it on that level if you fall in the end of the registration categories. We are running out of time. What I'd like to have both of your thoughts on what changes are going to be made in society. What difference is this going to make in our lives?
I sure want to get in one statement about how important we've talked a lot about how computers aren't important to us as in our individual jobs, perhaps, or we don't have to know a lot about computers. But I think computers are tremendously important to the future economic growth of the United States. I don't think we can ignore the tremendous need for us to stay on top of the world of technology and manufacturing technology, whatever you want to call computer technology, mm-hmm. because it certainly would be possible for us to become a second-class country if we don't keep up our research and keep up our manufacturing expertise in the building and designing of computer systems. Japan is already well ahead of us in the design of the fifth generation system, as they say. I think
what is a fifth generation system?
Kind of along the lines of what Tom was talking about before, a computer that can learn or generate some of its own information. They will be huge. We know that they will be significantly different than today's computers. We really need to keep pace with technology and with Japan.
Yeah, we have largely thought of our GNP in this country as product, as very much tied to product.
Nesbitt makes the point beautifully that the future of the United States is in its ability to produce information, and that's the information society is all about.
And we're going to be able to market this, you think?
Oh, very definitely. We are already marketing our technology and our information, our knowledge all over the world.
And curiously, that has raised all kinds of furor in the Third World. It turns out that a lot of Third World countries see the information technology and data communications and computer technology as the new wave of imperialism.
Right.
And so one of the great issues that has to be resolved is what we call trans-border data flow. That is, if you have data in one country and you wish to move it to another country, will they allow you to do that? A number of countries have said, no way, we're going to allow you to do that. AT&T and a number of other large corporations were setting up operations worldwide, and then through data communications, they were going to have all of their data processing centralized. And these countries said, sorry. And the way it's curious the way they do it. What they do is they non-standardize their telecommunication system just enough that it becomes virtually impossible for these conglomerates, these worldwide multinational companies, to be able to do that. And what they're saying is, hey, we feel like you're going to suck all of the data, crude analogy perhaps, but we're afraid you're going to suck all the data or information out of our little country and take it off to France or the United States or England, wherever. You're going to process it there, and that we're going to lose the benefit, and we will never end up growing our own computer technology and our own computer experts. And as a result, there are a lot of interesting legislative things coming up. Likewise, in trans-border data flow, another thing that's happening is that people are using it to get around some of the other laws. If country A has very strict privacy laws, they will ship their data over to country B, where credit laws and privacy laws aren't quite so strict, do the processing and credit checking over in country B, and then they send the results back, and thereby perhaps intrude and tramp on the rights of some of their citizens.
We have a question. Hello, you're on the air.
I would be curious if the man thought of what he said, if we only need 150,000 technicians, but 8 million fast food people, then we might just as well close the school and let the kids go to work at $3.25 an hour. What's it going to do for education? I put 37 years in, went through the whole process, and all I can think of is the years in the ghetto and the years in crowded classrooms with 44 students per class, and a budget of $300 for paper and pencil. What's it going to do for education? Can we presume that all of the GPAs are going to rise and there's going to be a great help? What about that aspect? Thank you.
Thank you.
Here, I can listen on the radio.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
I don't know that GPAs are going to rise because of computers. In fact, if anybody's been following the controversy going on about our College Board scores, they've been dropping over the last, 10 years now, and we've certainly had a lot of computers out in the field over that period of time. I think the point is that what jobs people are going to have, what job opportunities people in our society are going to have, the indications are that computer technology or computer prowess or computer programming and technical skills are not necessarily the ones that you want to have if you want to get into those jobs.
I think industry right now is making use of the computer to enhance education. And I'm sad to say that there is more education taking place in industry today than there is in public schools. I think that I'll come back to the theme that I brought up earlier. We really need to use computers to make all of us more productive, and for teachers, the challenge for teachers, I think, is to find ways that they can use the computer to teach more or teach students better.
I would like to just make one comment.
Certainly.
I received my master's degree in audiovisual from the University of Southern California, and I was audiovisual director. I have yet, after almost 40-some years in the classroom, if you count as a student, 50-some years, I have yet to see a teacher yet who even knew how to use a motion picture projector. They never stop it. They never go back and review it. They turn it on and they shut it off. And yet in your conversations tonight, you've gone backwards and forwards a lot, so it's going to take an awful lot to get the teachers to learn how to use these things.
Mm-hmm. I think the students will force it.
The students will force it.
Have you ever heard a student put his hand in the class and say, would you stop it and reverse that, please? I haven't. But I did stop it and reverse it. Thank you. It's been very interesting. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. You had made some very interesting comments. I think that is true. It's hard to know how to learn to use this technology in the most advantageous way. I have a fear that we're going to be asking a lot of questions that we know the computer can answer, saving a lot of data that we know the computer can save, well, like your friend with the checkbook thing, and that it isn't necessarily useful information, questions aren't necessarily useful questions to ask. We need not to be limited by the format.
Patty, you've glommed on to one issue that I think is super paramount. Just because we have powerful tools for computation and mathematical formulae, we have learned how to count very, very fast. But in so many cases, we've lost sight of what's worth counting. And that is the overriding human issue in computers.
Well, I guess we're out of time. I'm sorry, because I would really like to go on with this. Thank you, Con Dietz. Thank you, Tom Hassler. Our executive producer has been Carla Tanella. I'm Patty Kostelic, and I hope you all listen next week. I'd like to continue this sometime later in the summer, have another one of these. Thank you very much. Good evening for Home Fires.
This is KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, and we will now join a Prairie Home Companion.
From Minnesota Public Radio.
Through that door, I think we met somewhere before. Hello, love. Oh. Hello, love. Well, where in the world you been so long? I missed you so since you've been gone. Hello, love. Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to A Prairie Home Companion, coming to you live from the Orpheum Theater in downtown St. Paul, and presented every Saturday night at this time by Minnesota Public Radio and by this public radio station. With Mr. Bill Keith down there and his banjo, the man who wrote the book on the banjo, Gene Redpath is here from Edinburgh, Scotland. The Ostrushko All-Stars, Mr. Roy Blunt, Greg Brown, the Butch Thompson Trio, brought to you by your friends in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, including those biscuits, oh, they're tasty and expeditious. Hello, love. Oh, hello, love. Oh, thank you there, and hello to you on another Saturday night. Welcome to our live broadcast, brought to you by the Ringsack Rental Truck Line, this first portion of our show, and also by Powder Milk Biscuits on a beautiful, sunny, brilliant spring day here in downtown St. Paul. Let's kick it off here. Mr. Ostrushko, step up here with all these fine musicians. Do us that old theme song.
All right.
Here.
One, two, three. Way back in the mountains, way back in the hills, used to live a mountaineer, they called him Fiddlin' Will. Now he could play most anything, and some say he could sing, but the one thing that he likes to best was sawing on the string. So get out the fiddle, rising up the bow, look at old Will chapping his toes, he'll make music till the rafters ring, old man picking in a song on the string. Had a shindig and they all had victuals to eat. They'd always have to wait on Will for the frolic to be complete. When he comes down from the mountain, all the gals begin to sway. Sometimes he'd pick that old five string until the break of day. So tune up,
fast ring, tighten up the hide. Tell all the old folks get inside. We'll make music till the rafters ring. Old man picking in a song on the string. Tell all the old folks get inside. We'll make music till the rafters ring. Old man picking in a song on string.
Mr. Bill Keith down there on the banjo with all the rest of the band. This first portion of our show brought to you by Ringsack Rental Trucks, the rental truck line that makes the first-time truck driver feel like a pro. Yes, sir. Tell them about it.
Well, we're back in the mountains. Well, we're leaving our apartment and moving out to West St. Paul. Had to rent a truck, I was thinking of a big U-Haul. Let me tell you now, it felt fine when I got me a truck from the Ringsack line. I got behind the wheel, now I feel like a truck driving man.
Yes, it's Ringsack Rental Trucks when you want a rig that makes you feel like a trucker. They have those big 18-wheelers, four on the ground and 14 training wheels, so they look good, but they're easy to drive. Moving day is about the only time some of us guys get to operate a truck, so make it a good one from Ringsack Rental.
My rig's a little small, but that don't mean she's slow. Think I'll take her on the freeway and see how fast she'll go. Push the pedal down to the pan and turn on the citizens' band. I got behind. behind the wheel, now I feel like a truck driving man.
Yes, there's a CB in every Ringsack rental truck, along with a CB thesaurus of frequently used terms, so you won't sound foolish on the air. A list of nearby truck stops and an instruction booklet showing you how to walk when you leave the cab. Even if you never drove truck before, Ringsack makes you look and sound like a pro the first time.
I stopped at a roadside bar to do me some drinking. The waitress didn't say much, but I knew what she was thinking. I'd love to hold her tight, but I can never make believe it's all right. I'm on a 12-hour lease, and I gotta get it back tonight.
Ringsack rental trucks for the short-haul driver make you look good the first time. Thank you there, Dan Lund. Powder Milk Biscuits brings you this first half hour of our show as well. Let's bring up the trio here. Do you a tune here for your casserole dining and kitchen dancing pleasure here? Mr. Red Maddock on the drums and Bill Evans on the bass and himself seated over here at the piano.
How are you doing?
Not so bad. Let's do a tune for those people who are in their kitchens and probably with work to do getting supper ready, but who are in a romantic mood nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. I got a good one for that.
All right.
It's called Sweethearts on Parade.
Okay.
Here goes.
Butch Thompson Trio, they're playing for Powder Milk Biscuits. Heavens, they're tasty. Powder Milk Biscuits made from the whole wheat that gives shy persons the strength to get up and do what needs to be done.
As I guess we did last week, my, we got a tremendous response from the friends and neighbors out there to last week's commercial, in which we talked very briefly about not talking when you have nothing to say. Certainly hit a responsive chord in radio land. People sent us a lot of letters, some of them quite long, actually, describing in great detail people whom they knew who tended to run on and on and on and say nothing much of any great value, people who tend to be repetitive and to be redundant and to say the same thing over and over and over and over again. People writing in suggesting that we talk a great deal more about this whole no thought, no talk concept. They thought that we really owed it to America, I guess, in a way, to deal a great deal more with this subject in the very near future, or at least quite soon. So we'd like to thank all those people out there who wrote to us about it and remind them that these biscuits are tasty and expeditious. Pete, kick us off here.
One, two, yes. Three.
Well, has your family tried them powder milk? Has your family tried them powder milk? Well, if your family's tried them, oh, you know you satisfied them. They're the real hot item powder milk.